and Commerce Committee. Today is January 19th, 2017, a Thursday, and the time is 1:32. I'm Senator Mia Costello, chair of the committee, and with me this afternoon is Vice Chair Shelley Hughes. Welcome. Enjoy having you as the Vice Chair of the committee. And also with us today is Senator Gardner. Welcome. And also in the audience, I wanted to mention that Senator Von Imhoff has joined us, and also Representative Chris Birch has joined us. Thank you for making time in your schedules to participate in the Senate Labor and Commerce hearing this afternoon. So, as you know, we've been focusing on the economy. It's all about the economy, continuing our committee's hearings on the condition of the state's economy. And as you know, Alaska faces serious challenges, and these hearings are an opportunity for legislators and the public to better understand our economy. We're fortunate this afternoon, we're very fortunate to have with us five experts whose organizations have a long history of studying Alaska's economy. Today's discussion will help recap some of the information we've heard already as we started off the session at a fast clip. And your insight will help us sort out the data, the trends, and the policy options that are available to the state. The goal is to analyze the changes that we're seeing and to move Alaska's economy forward. Thank you very much for coming to Juneau. I'd like to now introduce the panelists. With us we have Dr. Ralph Townsend, who is the Director and Professor of Economics and also the Director of the Institute of Social and Economic Research. Mr. Joe Beadle, who is the Chairman of Northrim Bank. Thank you for taking time out of your schedule to be here. We also have Marcus Hatley, the President and Principal Economist of Northern Economics. Thank you for joining us. Mark Romick, the Deputy Executive Director of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And Dan Robinson, who is the Chief Researcher at the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, who kicked off this series of hearings that the committee has had on the economy. And thank you for returning for the panel discussion. As members know, there are two panelists here today that did not present for us previously, so we'll go ahead and start off the panel discussion with 5 minutes hearing from first Joe Beadle and then Mr. Romick. You can follow Mr. Beadle. Following that, we will open it up to committee members' questions, and we look forward to a vibrant discussion and hearing from you on your take on the state of our economy as we sit here today, and any observations or opinions or words of advice that you have for the legislature. And also, I did want to take a moment to thank the members of the public who have participated in the hearings. The committee does have a Facebook page, so before you put your phones away, take them out, open your Facebook app, and we're the Alaska Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. We'll be posting our meetings on the Facebook page and taking questions. If anyone wants to post questions on the Facebook page, we will try to have those asked, because we've many of our panelists have offered to reply to those questions, so I appreciate that opportunity. So with that, Mr. Beadle, yes, Senator Gardner.
If we're inviting the public to weigh in with questions that might be asked of the speakers, is there somebody monitoring?
My staff is monitoring Facebook. When that offer was made, I think it was as follow-up, but you know, I think we're the first committee in the legislature to have a Facebook page, and so we're learning and growing, but certainly want to accommodate the public, because this has been an important discussion across the whole state. So thank you for that.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hughes.
For the record, I just like the page.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Beadle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we've titled, or I've titled my segment, that the Alaska economy requires more certainty. And so it is uncertainty that is the subject of the day, and certainly the Alaska legislature cannot control certainty, but there are aspects of it that we will address, and the concerns that will give rise to what the issues are. So Northrim, publicly traded under NRIM, is a bank that is highly regulated. We're publicly traded on Wall Street. We're regulated. We're registered with the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission. And as such, you know, there's a thing called safe harbor, and that is when you're making suggestions about the future, you should not make investments simply on those suggestions. And so with that caveat, I want to talk about how we as a bank attract capital. And so as publicly traded, our shareholders are significantly institutional. So they represent very large, very sophisticated investment firms nationally. And as they look at our bank and they look at capital investment in our state, you know, this concept of understanding where to deploy capital is a very discerning and a very fickle subject matter, and planning does matter. And so, yes, we're 100% 907. This is our boundary. We live and work in Alaska. We're a community bank. We're Alaska proud. But that institutional capital is what I'm going to refer to today in terms of how does Alaska attract capital. So beyond management, the markets look at our economy and our situation that we find ourselves in. And while the state of Alaska as a government entity has some 15% plus or minus, whether you talk about headcount, number of employees, or salaries and wages, it represents 15% of the Alaska economy. So it doesn't necessarily drive the economy. It's not the state of Alaska government's fault. But we do look for direction. If the state needs to raise revenue, then certainly taxation is going to be an issue, and that's the circumstance we find ourselves in. So state government fiscal leadership does matter, and we're at the precipice that we'll talk about. The current lack of certainty in the state is a detractor from investment in Alaska. So, and we as a bank and banks in general today are witnessing less investment, less borrowing, and less confidence by our customers. So people are hunkering down. So we're already a little late on how the state might describe what it's going to do. And although it's not itself a drag on the economy, it in fact has been a stimulus to the economy. The state, over the last 20 years, deserves a lot of credit for the stimulus that it has provided and the stability that is provided. But we're in a new day and we're in a new affordability drag. So we make fun of Garfield, and Garfield says, "Whoa, do you ever feel like you don't know what's going on?" And then you say, "Isn't that great?" And of course, ignorance is bliss. But we really do have to take stock in where we are. And this,
Mr. Beto, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we've been joined by Senator Stevens, who's been here for a while. Welcome, Senator Stevens. Thank you.
The Department of Labor, we believe all of the state agencies do an outstanding job. The Department of Labor, the Department of Revenue, the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Commerce, the data that we live by comes from them. We really look forward to analyzing their data. ICER, Northrim has been involved with contributions to ICER of over $100,000 a year for more than 15 years, approaching $2 million, to help them do things like econometric modeling. Their outlook, not yet including this third step, what is the state going to do that will cause some impact on our economy before considering the third step? So oil down, trickle down, affecting other parts of the economy. State response not yet measured, and yet we're seeing this two-year trend of down 4.5. Northern Economics, great job yesterday in their presentation, 5 to 10 year outlook, as much as 7% down. And when we refer to down, I'm not referring to gross state product, I'm referring to specifically number of employed people. And then there's no return on this recession back to post highs. Regions will suffer differently. You know, I liked Northern Economics referring to the investment recession starting, you know, some 5-6 years ago. So we've had less investment in the state, and now that less investment has actually caused a people recession. And so that cycle is not beneficial. This concept of Northern Economics and their various modeling talks about as much as employment drop of 24,000. To put this in perspective, those that weren't present, population could drop as much as 30,000. And at this time, we don't have economic movers or stimulus, and so this R, standing for a recession, is really 3+ years, and then the potential that it's a benchmark, it's a new normal, it's not growing back, it's not the hockey stick or the U that comes back to stable. So the state, you know about your operations. I'm a person that looks at the CAFR, the Comprehensive Annual Financial Statements for the state, and the balance sheet is also shrinking from your net worth, your net assets, because of such things like unfunded liabilities, tax credits that are accumulating, new infrastructure that's not being added greater than the depreciation that's occurring. So we're losing net assets in our balance sheet. The permanent fund, fourth leg of the stool or third rail or whatever you want to call it, it is time to use it. And plus all moderate taxes from our banks and from my personal position. So rising interest rates, this nationalism versus globalism, risk to our state, this contagion that really concerns us is like self-fulfilling prophecy if we're overly concerned. And we are. We talk about the cliff, and here we have a mountain goat in Alaska that actually lives through these kind of environments. But frankly, business is not, as you're driving in your car and you ask Google and it says recalculating because you took a wrong turn. We actually do need to take a different turn, and we have to recalibrate. So our official bank position is that even though it'll cause a drag on the economy, for the state, for the legislature to figure out what level, and we encourage additional reduced spending, increased taxes, and then use of the permanent fund. But if the business sector, the investment sector, knows with some certainty what that might look at like, and it should be carried out over 3 to 5 years. We can't afford it all at once. But if we knew what it was like and the effective dates come in, so we believe that there's some positive trends from the federal administration change that occurs tomorrow in terms of our resource development. And of course, it's already been mentioned, tourism and healthcare are some opportunities. We support this SEDS project that the state is, and you have a hearing on that scheduled. We ourselves work on coaching our customers to survive in challenging times and actually thrive because there are opportunities. So the state and fiscal financial issues, we believe there are some tools for the state to use. We could go into those with Q&A. This Alaska capital investment is a serious issue. We are not attracting it in the private sector. It's hard for the state to do. We do need capital budgets. We do have great agencies like ADA and AHFC, and the native corporations are big. We need to offset some of the cost drivers, and certainly things are a little bit more affordable right now because people are sharpening their pencils. And with that, I conclude my opening comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Beadle. Are there any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Beadle. Good to see you back. Over the years, you've been here a lot. I appreciate that. And I'm glad you were there for the presentation by Northern Economics. After it was all said and done, the conclusion that I'd like to have your reflections on was that if we looked in the long term at an income tax, a cutting of the budget, or use of the permanent fund, their recommendation was that the best approach to keeping population and keeping jobs in Alaska was permanent fund earnings. Do you have any reflection on that?
So through the chair, Madam Chair, Senator Stevens, we support all the use of all of those tools, and certainly the permanent fund is capable of immediately providing some revenue use for the state. The others need implementation time and regulation, and their effective dates are delayed. So, but to this point, we believe that the implementation of income taxes and sales taxes cannot, they have to be moderate, they can, or minimal and growing to moderate. They cannot be high. They have to be specifically less than municipal and state markets elsewhere. So we should not strive for the highest in the state taxes, whether they be sales or income tax. Our bank pays 9.4% income tax because we're a C corporation, and frankly, that tax cannot grow. It would disadvantage us for our headquarters being here if you went much higher. It's one of the higher in the country.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens?
No, thank you.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have three questions, and I think they're fairly short, so I'll stop whenever you want me to. First of all, what is SEDS? I'm unfamiliar with that term.
So the Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy is a term that is coined by the U.S. Economic Development and the state of Alaska does not have a current SEDS. They last for 5 years in duration. An example is the Arters, specifically Anchorage, wanted a grant from the EDA, Economic Development Administration, for the Port of Anchorage, and they said, your SEDS is outdated, you can't qualify for a grant. So most of our Arters, who you will hear from, have their comprehensive economic development strategy. I happen to be on the committee. I appreciate what the Commissioner of Commerce is doing, and I have a slide that talks about that it should be meaningful for what the state is going to do, and simply not the fluff that I read in most SEDS documents. Quality of life is important, but the economic engine in our case needs the attention.
Yeah. Thank you.
Senator Gardner?
Thank you. So on page 7 of your presentation, when you talk about some of the things that we need and you say not much, need material, meaningful employment / investment, can you give us a little more detail about what you think would be qualify under that?
So, you know, cottage industry is a wonderful thing. Small agriculture is a wonderful thing. The self-actualization of an individual is very important, and the state should encourage such a thing. But to be meaningful in our state, we need second stage meaningful growth from entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial investment that is not the current onesie-twosies or I'm supplementing, you know, my food on my table. It needs to be meaningful capital and operating investment that employs meaningful people. So all of it is good, and you don't stop doing all the things in society that are healthy. But we need to focus on movers. And so a lot of the SEDS documents talk about quality of life and entertainment and arts, and those are important, but today's focus needs to be on these jobs that we're losing and how to get them back.
Thank you. And if I might, I think that's a great segue into another question I have, which is the Senate President had said that he's very comfortable with the state being on the edge of a precipice and thinks it's a good thing because it holds down spending, but as Dan Robinson, I think it was yesterday, said in answer to another question I had, and you'll undoubtedly agree, I think you said the same thing here, that very uncertainty is a drag on investment decisions. So do you agree that it's good to stay at the edge of a precipice? You see value in it?
You know, we all tend to make those tough decisions when it comes to a difficult time. We are in a difficult time. We're already at this precipice. We already have so much uncertainty that any amount of certainty coming back is going to help. The adage that it takes a perfect emergency to measure people's mettle and to make decisions, we're there. So whether we really can't afford to defer it for that cliff to get steeper. We need to start acting on it now, because anything we do, if we can do it in moderation over 2 or 3 or 4 years instead of the creating that cliff, is going to be important. So let's make sure we don't make that cliff without parachutes and out without a gradual decline.
Thank you.
Landing, soft landing.
Thank you. And next, I'd like to go to Mark Romick. Oh, excuse me, Senator Hughes.
Yes. Thank you. Excellent presentation. And you've packed a lot of material in a few slides, I tell you. You mentioned the net depreciation of infrastructure assets. And there are a number of projects that the administration has decided to stop or put on hold. And that all plays into the health of the economy. If you were governor, would you have put those projects on stop?
Yeah, I'm not qualified to give an answer to that. I will say that our net assets in the state, and it's really good to look at unrestricted net assets, just as it is to look at general fund, because you can determine general fund and you can spend unrestricted state assets. So total capital or net assets of the state, you know, are in the $60 billion range, but most all of those are restricted and you can't do anything with them, like the permanent fund. So the unrestricted assets on the balance sheet have shrunk significantly, and in relation to some of the liabilities, the pension and now the tax credits. And the fact that we're depreciating about now five times as much money, well, this assumes we put in $300-400 million in capital. We're depreciating three times that amount. And so you're shrinking even when you talk about capital assets in the state. So your balance sheet is shrinking and your income statement is actually showing a loss. So it's a very dangerous thing on two counts.
Right. Senator Hughes, follow up?
No, I'm fine.
Thank you. And next, we're going to be hearing from Mark Romick with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And then following, Mark, following your presentation, I would respectfully ask the panelists to say your name prior to replying to any questions, because we do have people listening to just the audio, and it makes it kind of tricky to figure out who's saying what, so you'll have to own your comments, essentially. So thank you. Mr. Romig?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a first comment. I do have a lot of statistics on the housing market that I didn't put together in the presentation, but I can make that available to the committee at your request. All the things that I'm going to be referring to, we have lots of data, as you might imagine. What I'm going to do is kind of stick to the top of the trees and talk a little bit about where we are in the housing market in Alaska right now from what we know, and then if I may make a few comments about what I heard in the two presentations yesterday that I think particularly resonate within the housing sector. I think everybody understands that, you know, housing is very important in an economy. We all have a house. The house is a foundation of most people's lives, and it isn't necessarily a primary industry like oil and gas, but it is a reactive industry in which follows the general movement of the economy. And as recent history has shown us, in the 80s in Alaska and in the 2008-2007 period in the United States, housing can have a very big impact on whether a correction or softening in the market is long or short. And just give you perspective, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the percentage of gross or state domestic product in Alaska that's related to the housing sector and the insurance industry, which is the way that they bundle things together, is roughly about 10% of the gross state product, which is generally between $3 to $5 billion. So it's a fairly substantial amount of money that is rolling through the housing sector at any given time. In terms of economic impact from housing, the National Home Builders Association estimates that for every homes that are built around an average of $350,000 to $370,000 a unit, it produces about $30 million in wages, about $6 million in taxes to local taxing jurisdictions or state jurisdictions if there's state taxes, and about 410 direct jobs for every 100 houses that are built. Because of the annual,
I'm sorry, Mr. Romick, the noise just obscured what you said. Do you mind repeating that for how many homes that are built? the number?
Sure. So for every 100 homes built that average about 378,000 per unit, it produces about $30 million in wages, about $6 million in taxes and other government revenue, depending on whether you have state taxes on top of that, and about 400 direct jobs. In addition to that, the ongoing expenditures that households make produces about $6 million in annual revenues for them, other types of purchases that they do to maintain their home, and which translates into about 78 additional jobs. So there's a fairly significant impact to an economy from housing construction, and anybody that's in a housing construction world knows that, you know, they then have to go buy appliances and carpet and all the things. And so there's a big spillover benefit to investment in the housing world. Overall, to this point, I think I would agree with Dan's comments yesterday that there's no major sign of trouble in the housing statistics that we have. Foreclosures and delinquencies are extremely low in Alaska. It's one of the few measures that it's good to be at the bottom of in the United States. We're well below the national average on both those measures and have been for some time. Everybody, I've been to a number of presentations in the last couple of weeks, and everybody likes to talk about the 80s, and, you know, nobody likes to talk about the music of the 80s, but they just like to talk about the 80s. We are in a completely different place than we were in the 80s, primarily because there's been no housing bubble. And I think that people that are around in the 80s recognize that there was a massive growth in housing stock in the 80s just before the downturn, and that has not happened. And in fact, permitting across the state has been relatively anemic over the last couple of years. There's not a lot of new inventory that's being added to the market, which, you know, is both bad and good. It's bad if your job is to sell property, but it's good if you want to maintain pressure on sales prices and create more stability in your economy as people might be slowing down their expenditures. So across the state, it varies substantially, and I think that was a point that Dr. Gutabi made yesterday, that there's a lot of regional differentiation in the economy. That's the same is true with the housing industry. Job cuts have different effects across the state. They'll also have different effects on the housing market as well. According to the forecast that I went to earlier this week from the real estate community, I think the real estate community generally feels that most markets are in kind of a moderate to mild activity at the moment. Things tend to slow down a little bit in the fall, but this year, 2016, was, I think, generally considered to be not bad. There was fairly stable sales prices, fairly stable inventory. Looking at 2017, it looks like the inventory will be down a little bit, but generally fairly stable. That doesn't necessarily mean there hasn't been some softening in certain areas. One of the things that we track very closely are vacancy rates in the rental market. And anecdotally, we've heard from people around the state that there's been, you know, some softening to the extent where the landlords have had to start offering concessions to attract new tenants. It may have been, you know, earlier this year or late last year, you know, you could put an ad on Craigslist, you get 70 phone calls, and you know, you shut down your Craigslist account. It may be that you get 5 or 10 now, and people are having to be a little bit less choosy about who they rent to.
Mr. Romick, I just wanted to interrupt you briefly to say that I'd like to welcome Senate President Pete Kelly, and I certainly appreciate the conversations we've had about the importance of a committee like this setting the stage for the challenge and opportunities that we face, and how you've described those as challenges, but an opportunity to do what's necessary. So thank you for coming this afternoon. Go ahead, Mr. Romick.
Madam Chair. So So that's kind of where we are right now. There still is a very high need for affordable housing throughout Alaska, particularly in rural Alaska, where the housing stock is much older and in some cases in worse shape. You know, there's been a lot of research that's been done about the close connection between safe, quality housing and healthcare. And I know from yesterday there was a long discussion about healthcare. There's a growing body of research that suggests that, you know, healthy housing is important in controlling the growth of health costs, particularly in lower income populations. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the federal picture, because a good portion of Alaska Housing's budget comes from the federal government. You know, funding for affordable housing and homeless programs has been relatively stable at the federal level. I think with the new administration, everybody's kind of taking a wait-and-see approach on what might change. From a positive standpoint, discussions about deregulation of the housing industry from where we are right now, I think, is positive and could add some efficiencies into the way that programs are administered. You know, the other big looming question is, you know, the proverbial what to do about Fannie and Freddie and where that money that they generate going to go. So those are all kind of wait and see, but right now the federal side is fairly stable. If I could, I just want to emphasize two points that I heard yesterday in the presentation, and one is about the complexity of the impacts that happen when there's a change in the economy through the multiplying effects that happen. And I think I think Mr. King mentioned gave an example of, you know, the difference between two effects is, one, when you lose your home, you know, you have nothing and you leave the state or you move on, and that causes a big shock. But if you just have a reduction in income, then, you know, you may prioritize and you may not paint your house and you may not buy other things. I think in the housing market, those impacts go one step further, and that is in that if you are in a position where you have to sell in a flat market or a very competitive market where, you know, you can't get what you thought you were going to be able to get for it, that is going to help put downward pressure on home values, which then translates into potentially changes in tax assessments, which then affects the ability of local governments to collect property tax, which then puts local governments in the position of having to make tougher choices as well, and it also means that in the construction industry there are also those same types of decisions that have to be made about, you know, whether they need to move on from building new houses or whether they need to move into remodeling or whether it's something that they want to continue to do. And then the other thing that I just wanted to emphasize too was just reemphasize the interconnectedness of by geography, and I think Dr. Gutiabi mentioned that as well. And with that, I'll conclude my comments and take any questions.
Thank you very much. Appreciate especially you remarking on some of the hearings that we've had before. And I wanted to start out by asking Mr. Robinson, who's the chief researcher with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. So if you read through the economic trends that your department puts out, it was noticeable to me that when you wrote about the recession, that the industries that have been hit first and hardest and that will be trickling down were the oil and gas industry and the construction industry. And yet we just heard Mr. Romick from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation say that he sees no major sign of housing trouble. So how do you respond to that seeming contradiction?
Madam Chair, it's a couple of responses, and some of this is speculative because the data is happening as we speak, and there's a lag in most of these data sets. One thing that Mark just talked about was that we don't have the vulnerabilities in our housing market that we had before. It's solid. The lending has been different. We don't have the vulnerabilities that we had in the 80s or that the U.S. housing market had in 2009. I think, so that's part of it. Another part is our age structure and questions we have about what's happening to the people who have lost their jobs. Because as I mentioned yesterday, we haven't yet seen large-scale population loss. We've seen a net loss to migration of about, so far, 15,000-20,000 people that's been compensated for by natural increase, births minus deaths. So think of what may have happened to a state worker in Juneau, for example, who retired, wasn't replaced, stays in Juneau, or an oil worker who near the end of their career. Remember, our age structure is older. We have fewer 20-year-olds. We have more people who are in a better position to stay than they would have been in the 80s, for sure. So some of that is speculative because of some of the things we do know about our age structure. Some of that we will know in a year or two when we see what happens to net migration. But that pattern, remember that a job loss doesn't right away necessarily lead to a population loss. That's good for housing, among other things. So two parts, some differences between now and previous periods, and then that lag factor and our age structure.
Thank you, and I'd like to welcome Senator Meyer. And since we have the benefit of a panel here, I'd like to start having a discussion that includes all the panel members. And so, Mr. Robinson, if you were up here being able to ask questions of the panelists, what question would you ask your colleagues there at the table?
It's a long, long list. It's an impressive group, and I don't know where I would start. So I will pass, because it really would be, I mean, we would go on for days, the five of us.
Not even one question?
Well, there were several things that Joe talked about that were interesting to me, that we are not experts on capital and how it moves. Investment in Alaska and what affects it, I'd be interested to hear a little bit more about that and what might kind of resurrect or revitalize some of the downward trends there.
And the obvious person is Mr. Beadle, but I think I'm going to first turn to Mr. Hartley and see if you want to take a first stab at that. The question being, what affects investment?
Yes, Madam Chair, Marcus Hartley with Northern Economics. I guess I'm going to go back to the slide that Joe has up on front here on the screen. I don't know if the members of the audience online can see that, but investors want to have some level of certainty. And investors never have perfect certainty. That's, if it wouldn't be investment then. I mean, why even go fishing if you know you're just going to catch a 100-pound halibut every time?
I'd go fishing if I knew I was going to catch a 100-pound
But the point is that certainty is a critical factor in investment. And we look around, and am I, as a small business owner, supposedly for-profit business owner, I want to know what's going on before I make that next investment decision. And for me, my capital is employment. My capital is hiring another worker or not getting rid of a worker. And I need to have more certainty before I do that. I'm not going to make an investment if it looks like the state could do any number of things, but they're not making a decision to do any one thing. The lack of that decision is critical in my decision making. If I don't know, if we took any of the three scenarios that we modeled, if you told me one of them that you were going to do, now I've got some certainty. Even if it's a crap decision, I know what's going on, and that will help me make a better decision in investment. And I think that's one of the big keys that investors need. We need to know what's going on. to the extent that we can. I mean, there's all kinds of uncertainty out there. But we can fix, you want to fix the certainty or the uncertainty that you can. I think that's enough for me.
Thank you. Mr. Beadle, do you want to take a stab at the question, which was what affects consumer investment and investment?
So I'll more address investment at a significant enterprise level than, say, consumer investment, because I think there are differences. Consumers will follow the institutional core in investors. So right now, as an example, this concept of a change in administration nationally, Washington, D.C., inauguration tomorrow, this potential for relief of regulation, and in the particular case of a bank like ours, a community bank, but yet an SEC publicly traded company, the Sarbanes-Oxley stuff we'd all gotten used to for good reason, but Dodd-Frank and the multitude of regulatory issues on banking has been a drag. That potential movement back is going to be a huge benefit to banks. There are, I'll call them carpetbaggers that came to Alaska because we were relatively rich when others were poor. The 08 recession that has been well discussed in this panel, Alaska was a place to come to. And so resource development and mining in particular, and if you look at comparable markets, the liberal nature of Trudeau and Canada as compared to potentially the United States and Alaska as a border state can be a resource opportunity for us in mining. And if core industry grows, then mining products are going to be more in demand. So an investor, the stability has already been addressed, and in particular, behavior of the government to stay alive and the opportunity to tax is a concern, and to what level that tax occurs, how reasonable is it, and how knee-jerk is it, and then honoring commitments. Is important. Again, the state doesn't drive the economy, but influences the economy, and I think we look to the state for how they respond right now during these very difficult times. They've provided stimulus before, can't really afford to provide as much stimulus today, but how do you create a fiscal plan that gets us back in balance is important for us.
Thank you, Mr. Beadle. In the previous hearing, Senator Stevens had asked several presenters about the state not honoring the oil tax credits, and you had mentioned keeping our word or commitment. Could you elaborate on your view of the importance or how we address that issue moving forward?
I'll use some very simple examples, Madam Chair. If you went in today because taxes are due April 15th and you went to H&R Block and you had your opportunity to get a refund, H&R Block would say, today, you know, I'll keep $50, but I'll give you the $500 that out of your $550 net return. We're so sure that the federal government is going to honor that tax refund that it's instantly exchanged in the market. Alaska Housing Finance is a conduit for the U.S. Treasury to provide tax credits for low-income housing, and we as a bank buy tax credits. They become then equity investments for low-income housing developers, and that we've invested in $20 million in those tax credits over the last 5 years, Northrend Bank, and we get to offset our tax liability over 15 years, and that 15-year period, we have to bet that every year there's a deduction on our tax return, so that we're paying less, but we're also doing a public good with low-income housing. So those are bankable, they're exchanged on the market, and the fact that our state tax credits have now not been exchangeable on the market, it is a debilitating affair, and so it is a challenge. It's also an opportunity for the state and the oil companies to negotiate a different strategy and try to make things right in some manner or fashion instead of a percentage of your production tax. By statute is the only amount you'll pay, which equates to a 30-year payback. Well, a 30-year payback wasn't the terms that they expected. They expected as the H&R Block example. So we need to figure out a way to step that up and honor those commitments.
Thank you. And I, before I move to members' questions, I wanted to give Dr. Townsend an opportunity to comment on anything you've heard so far.
Yes, I'm Ralph Townsend, the director of ICER. I guess I'd say two things about the comments. The first one is just to the oil and tax credit issue. The size of money is so large at this point that it is creating a lot of uncertainty, not only for the industry, but also for state government. And it just seems to me that resolving that, however it's done, again, there have been conjectures about various alternative ways to perhaps solve it over some period of time, but solving it and getting it behind us is clearly an important part of resolving the uncertainty. It is a very large part at this point. The liability, if you treat it as a part of our current expenses, is a very large part. So it just seems like something we have to resolve. I'd elaborate a little bit on the piece of why the state budget feels so uncertain. And let me preface my comments by saying I apologize that Professor Gatavi had to teach today and that you have a very weak substitute in myself. I've only been here for 5 months. But as somebody from outside, I'd explain the reason why uncertainty is an issue is that every economist and economists who are working for business can look at the state's budget and say, this is not sustainable. There is a point at which things will have to change. And it is not so far in the future that I can ignore it in my planning. So I have two concerns as a business person. The first one is, are we going to delay this decision to the point where we're going to result in 15 or 20,000 job losses every year for 2 years? Because that will cause a crisis in the housing market. I mean, if we, the precipice that we're talking about here, the issue is that a hard landing will have other effects on the economy, which will put us into a more severe recession, because people don't have the time to react. So they're worried about a very real worry that we would create the losses we've seen in these 2 years, perhaps for 2 years having twice each of those losses. That's the kind of numbers that potentially are down the road. The second thing is, I think businesses can see one of several things has to happen. There almost has to be some sort of adjustment on the revenue side, whether it's a new one of the two broad-based taxes, some adjustment to the PFD. Businessmen can see that the arithmetic doesn't really add up without doing something there in the long run. Can we do something in the short run without doing it? Yes. But in the long run, it needs to be addressed. If my business is one that depends on the PFD, I'd like to know. If my business is one that competes on the Internet, I'd like to know what the sales tax is going to be. And for many businesses, those kinds of issues, am I prepared to invest in my business when I know I rely on the PFD every October? If the news is the PFD is going to be smaller, I can plan around it. I can decide how many stores to build. But if I don't know, and I'm not going to know for 2 or 3 years, I'll just have to put my decision off. And that's the mechanical side, the two pieces of certainty. It's that threat of a large reduction which would hurt everyone in a short period of time, but also a recognition that whatever is done is going to have consequences for different kinds of businesses, and they would like the opportunity to plan for that rather than face it in a 1 or 2 year period.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start off with the committee questions as chair. Take that advantage, I guess. The question was asked, of all the options before the state, which one gets us further down the road in terms of addressing the challenge we face and has the least amount of pain? And the answer was savings. It was the permanent fund, either an endowment approach, management of the fund, or use of it. And so my question then is, do you agree with that? And I guess we'll just start with Dr. Townsend. The question being, of the options facing the state, do you agree that savings has the use of the permanent fund in some manner, addresses it most significantly, and also has the least pain to the economy?
Well, I think it's important to remember the context in which that was made, and that was in the next year or two, which of these will have the least result. And we already know that because for the last 2 years, we have been spending from the CBR, and we know that that has reduced the pain. So if the question is, should we draw, if we want to put the pain off as long as possible, should we take it out of our savings account? That's just like saying, if I lose my job, will it be less painful to take money out of my retirement fund in the short run? And the answer is yes. The long-run question is much more complicated. And I think that that's the issue of certainty. In the very long run, the issue we need to look at in government is, what government do we want? What services do we want? What things are we willing to pay for? How much child care, how much child protective services does the state of Alaska want to provide? That ultimately we have to, that is where we need to be. We don't want to be buying things that we don't want. On the other hand, we don't want to not be buying things we do want simply because we've got a short-term crisis. So in the long run, we want to be looking for decisions that get us the state government we want. In the medium term, I think our goal is to manage the macroeconomic impacts on the state of Alaska from the economy in a way that minimizes the disruption that it causes for the economy. And I think the message that really was not that we should do one versus the other, it is, as Mr. Beadle said, in the long run, we're going to do all of these things. The question is the timing. And I think what the story you're hearing is, we've currently suffered 2 years, we've suffered 1 year, we're looking at another year of 2%, a year beyond that with no changes, 1%, if we continue, if we were to take large cuts, Jonathan King's numbers showed we'd be looking at a third year of 2%. Is that a good strategy? And I think the answer is what we want to do is use the benefit that Alaska has going in is it has funds in the CBR, it has funds in the earnings reserve, to manage a transition from the current situation to one we have readjusted how we finance government. And I think hearing that to minimize the pain in the short run, relying somewhat more heavily in the short run upon continued withdrawals, I don't think any of us would say that you should close the state budget gap this year, that you should take $3 billion or $1.5 billion, however, out of the economy in 1 year. The question is, what period should we be taking it out over, and how to stage that process so that we get a soft landing rather than a very sharp landing.
Thank you. Mr. Beadle?
Well, I'll be fairly short because that was a great answer, and I addressed it early in my comments. The earnings reserve is available. The liquidity that the state needs, we already need the liquidity that we have for emergencies or simply to fund for working capital and to give us a hedge, so to speak. So I don't believe that we should continue to proceed without utilizing the permanent fund to a significant level, and that means 4.5% to 5%, regardless of what that does to intergenerational value, what we call inflation proofing. And by the time you've implemented your sales income taxes, your fuel taxes, and your other industry taxes, by the time they're implemented, we're going to be 2 years down the road before that cash flow is in the bank. So trying to do it now, in our opinion, is the right decision, and you can make some effective dates 2 years hence in some of those examples. So it takes all of the above, and utilizing the permanent fund reserves, earnings reserves today, to a significant extent, will give a lot of certainty to the markets.
Mr. Hartley?
This is Marcus Hartley again. I guess my first response is that I'm not sure that I agree that a cut in the permanent fund in and of itself is better than, say, a institution of a broad-based tax. I think we need to utilize the permanent fund to help us get through this kind of current crisis, but I think that we also need to think about generating or starting to earn, creating an income tax is, I guess, my preference. And I think about that from a couple perspectives. First of all, I have been in Alaska now for 20 years, almost 30 years now, and mostly as a fisheries economist. And one of the things that has always struck me is that, boy, we have a fantastic fishery resource here, but all of the earnings, not all of the earnings, a very large portion of those earnings are taken home by owners and crew members in particular, who don't live in the state and who earn a lot of money in the state, who make a living in the state, and who basically spend nothing here. They don't get our permanent fund dividend, but they do get our resource. They're not all of our resources. They're federal government resources, federal water fisheries. If we have a state income tax, I believe that they would be payers of that, that we could get part of that money to pay for our budget from other people who are utilizing our resources. I mean, the resources off our coast. Similarly, we look at the oil fields and all of the... Sorry, I'm not speaking close enough to the mic. All of the oil workers that are from out of state, how much do they contribute to our economy other than in generating all of their labor? And that's a big bonus for us. But if we have an income tax, they would also be contributing. So every dollar that they're paying in an income tax is a dollar that I don't have to take a hit on from my permanent fund. From my perspective, I would rather see that income tax generating those funds from people that are benefiting from what we have to offer here in terms of employment, but who aren't necessarily living here. When I see the permanent fund cuts, I see that's everybody in Alaska paying, but nobody from outside of Alaska paying.
Thank you for your answer. Mr. Romick.
Can I ask a question?
Certainly. Senator Stevens, followed by Senator Meyer.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, Ms. Hartley, it always seems strange to me that, you know, you're absolutely right. The crew members do not pay taxes to the state of Alaska, but they do pay taxes to the state of Washington. The oil crews pay taxes to the state of Texas. So it's not as if we're adding a tax on top of them. We would just be collecting the tax that they're paying elsewhere. Isn't that true?
Well, not necessarily. The state of Washington, for example, where a lot of the fishing crew members come from, has a sales tax and not an income tax. And so, no, they don't pay a tax. They do pay a tax on the things that they purchase at home.
Say in Oregon, they would pay a tax.
In the state of Oregon, they would pay a tax. They pay an income tax. Although I'm not 100% sure on how that... Here's what I know. When I do business in Oregon, I don't pay Oregon income tax. I have to be living there and working there in order to pay that Oregon income tax. I'm not 100% certain if those fishermen have to pay the taxes that, or the revenue that they earn. They probably do. But I also think that we can construct a tax, an income tax, and I'm not a tax specialist. Income that is earned here, I believe, can be taxed as income tax from this state. And I think that having other people pay is always better than having me pay. Sales taxes is the same way. When you have tourists come into the state, they're going to pay some sales tax. My personal opinion is that sales tax are less affordable by people that earn less money. It's a regressive system. I'd be perfectly fine with the sales tax because I make a fair amount of money. My unemployed brother-in-law is not going to be okayed with a sales tax. He's going to be better off with an income tax because he's going to, presumably, it will be a more progressive system. That's just, again, my opinion. And I'm not a tax expert, but that's the way I see things.
Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up again on your comment on the income tax, I think this might have come up actually yesterday when the Department of Labor told us that 20% of our workforce is out-of-state workers. So, in other words, to capture the money from those 20% out-of-state workers, who some of them don't get paid that much, the fishing and tourism, you're going to be penalizing the 80% that actually live here and work here. So that's why the sales tax is a little more attractive because you have almost 2 million tourists coming up every year. They expect to pay sales tax. And if you set up the sales tax in such a way that, you know, in the summertime, maybe you collect 6%, and then in the off season or off months, you lower that to 3%. So then that way your locals could buy their big ticket items in November, December, or whenever. But the concern with both the sales tax and income tax, and I think that's why we opted for the PFD restructure, was that both of those require hiring more state employees. 50 to 60 is what the fiscal note said for either one. And we are kind of in the opposite mode right now. We're trying to reduce the amount of state employees because every state employee you hire, then you've got medical benefits, you got retirement benefits, you know all the benefit, all the concerns there, workers' comp, et cetera. So that's why I'm a little surprised that you would prefer the income tax, say, over some structuring of the PFD.
Madam Chair, again, this is Mr. Hartley. I guess I do see room for both of those. A PFD reduction, I think, is an okay idea. But I do think that there's a lot of folks, particularly lower-income folks, rural area folks, that have an outsized dependence on that permanent fund. In areas where employment is limited, the permanent fund might be a majority of a family's income. And by cutting that, you're cutting that livelihood. And I think that you would end up seeing, with a bigger permanent fund versus a tax, a bigger permanent fund cut relative to a tax, you would see a lot more pain in the rural areas than we are right now. And I think that would be disproportionately felt in those areas. And it seems like that's not that great of an idea. It seems like it's a bigger burden on the less fortunate people than it is on the more fortunate people, in my opinion, again. And that's what I think, anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Hartley. So we do have a question that came through our committee's Facebook page, which, if you're not following, happens to be Alaska Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. And I want to thank John for sending this in. I'm going to ask it of the panelists and just see who's interested in responding. His question is, local businesses pay local property and sales tax and hire Alaskans. These businesses face competition, however, from internet sales. Should the state develop a policy to capture some of those transactions? Let's see. Mr. Robinson, do you have any comments on that?
Kind of.
So generalizing a little bit and kind of going back to the last question, any question about the impact on the economy, I think it's guided by what is the money doing now. So when it's specific to the internet tax question, that's been around for a while, brick and mortar, fairness between the internet, all those things. And they're important because it changes the balance of the cost of what consumers buy. So, and that's about all I'll say about that because it's some important policy questions and very detailed. But as we talk about different options, one thing to keep in mind is what the money is doing now. So the permanent fund earnings, for example, as Dr. Townsend described, and as Gunnar Knapp talked about last session when he presented to you, it's put aside for future use, which is important. But if you take that now, that's because it's not being used now other than to grow, which is incredibly valuable. But in the short term, that has less of an impact on an economy. Any tax that goes to non-revenues, whether it's income or sales, tends to have a smaller impact on Alaskan's economy. When you tax, whether it's income or sales, basic economic theory, all other things being equal, you get a little bit less of that thing. But I won't say much more because we're rigidly policy neutral. That's not our role to push one policy or another. But economically, I like quite a bit I'm going to call you doctor. We just got a promotion.
I'm not a doctor.
Mr. Harvey said about...
I'm a surgeon, not a doctor.
About the specifics are less of an economic concern than the fact that there is this uncertainty about which direction. That's the bigger economic cost, short term certainly, and long term certainly as well.
Thank you. And Dr. Townsend.
Yes, Senator Costello. I'd address that question from John in two ways. The first one is there has been for some time, of course, a national debate over creating a mechanism for states to collect revenues from internet sales. And that's an ongoing national debate. I probably don't need to go over it, but the players are, and the players to some extent are changing sides. Some of the larger players are realizing that they're active, those players like Google, when they enter a state, physically they're then required to collect income tax, sales taxes. And so some of those large players are saying maybe a single uniform system would actually be better than the hodgepodge that's coming out in the internet right now. I don't know how long that's going to be resolved, but I have to imagine at some point it will be resolved. But the second point gets more to the question of taxation design in general. And that is that if I'm someone who's competing with internet sales, and you're in a state that has a 9% sales tax, I'm going to be quite concerned because that's a big margin. If I'm in a state that has a 2% sales tax, I'm not going to be as concerned. There are advantages. So one of the issues on taxation that comes from economics is the broad and low suggestion. That is, if you're going to introduce a tax, use as broad a base as possible so you can keep the rates lower. If you only tax half of the income, and the federal government is a good example, there are lots of kinds of income that are exempt. And so consequently, the highest marginal tax bracket is 39% at this point. And we could have much lower, and probably be good for the economy, if we had a broader definition of income and lower tax rates. And I would say that applies to any design, whether you're talking about sales taxes or income taxes. And that's the temptation, I think, for legislative bodies is someone comes, oh, tax everybody else, don't tax me. And if enough people say that and you've exempted half of the sales or half of the income, then you need twice as high a rate. And then you get into the people who do face that higher rate now face serious disruption from competition from interstate. So that is absolutely something to keep in mind as you design one of these taxes. But as Joe Beadle said, it is not necessary for the state to get into the 6 or 8 or 9% sales taxes that are in other states if you use a broad definition of the sales tax given the amount of money that would raise in Alaska. So that's a detail, an important detail,
because it will make a real difference in the long run. And so when you get to the point, is it a sales tax versus an income tax, those implementation details do matter, and I would certainly, I think, various economic advisors would be able to come back and talk about how to avoid as much as possible the distortionary effects that taxes can create for an economy.
Thank you for that answer, Dr. Townsend. Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you ready for a different question?
Certainly.
Okay. Well, again, I apologize for being late, Madam Chair, but I was at a yoga lunch and then served on a panel after the lunch, similar to what you guys are, and I know the hot seats you're in. So, but one of the comments that they made was that oil and gas jobs have an 8-to-1 effect. For every one job that they hire in oil and gas, that's 8 other jobs that are going to be hired somewhere else in the economy, and vice versa. For every job in the oil industry that gets laid off, you lose 8 other jobs somewhere else, whether it be McDonald's or Fred Meyer's or what have you. I guess I'd like to get your opinion on if you agree with that, because I think in yesterday's presentation, I believe it's from ICER, the multiplier effect was more like a 3-to-1, or actually 2.71 to 1. It was still one of the highest multiplier effects, an oil and gas job, obviously, but not quite 8. So does anybody have any? Again, I think it came out of the ICER report from.
Madam Chairman, the 2 to 2.7 did come from the ICER presentation.
And that was Dr. Townsend speaking.
Dr. Townsend, was that is part of the issue? I wasn't here for Bassoon's presentation, but that kind of a multiplier may have been an output multiplier or income multiplier, which are typically in the range of 2, relative to a jobs kind of jobs to jobs multiplier. So I don't know if that was it a jobs to jobs.
No, you're right. It was an income multiplier. This is Ralph Townsend, Madam Chairman. The answer is yes. Those were income multipliers, I believe.
And that's a very different kind of economic multiplier, and easy to become confused on, I think. But again, I wasn't here listening to that. But I remember a conversation that I had with Jonathan King, and again, this is Marcus Hartley, with Jonathan King about this at an earlier date, and we were talking about output multipliers, economic output multipliers, which is the total amount of sales or spending that is generated from a particular job, say, and those range, you know, a really good multiplier, a really good economic output multiplier might be 2 or 3. That those are, wow, those would be eye-popping in Alaska. Jobs-to-jobs multipliers are typically quite a bit higher than that. So it's important to know which of those we're talking about, because they have a different set of ranges that are important and distinctly different.
Okay. Now, I appreciate that explanation.
Senator Meyer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So what would be the multiplier effect of a state employee job? Is it as high as the 2.71 that ICER had for the oil and gas?
Madam Chairman, this is Ralph Townsend from ICER again. That was not in the presentation, but I believe yesterday Dr. Gutabi indicated that it would be 1.7 to 1.9 for state employees. And again, I think there was quite a discussion of this yesterday, that when you get into the jobs that typically involve professional employees, that is healthcare workers, oil workers, state workers, you end up with relatively large multipliers, because they are buying, in particular, services that are locally produced. That is, they go out to eat at expensive restaurants, for example. Whereas if you're talking about multipliers for a retail trade industry, those are typically lower, because those employees are earning lower incomes typically, and they are spending a lot of their income on things that came from outside the state. So they're buying a lot of groceries. most of those groceries came from outside the state. So the multipliers are more less a characteristic of its construction or whatever. It's the mix of employees that they have, those industries that tend to have employees that spend a lot of their income on services in the state generate larger multipliers than those people who spend most of their income on food and other kinds of, or the kinds of goods we would get at the big box stores, for example, that largely come from out of state. So it's really the high earning industries, of which healthcare would be a strong one, oil and gas, professional services, and actually state workers. State employment is relatively high as compared to retail trade, for example.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Senator Meyer, I've asked for a comprehensive list of all of the multipliers because I think some of the committee members would find it valuable to go through and have a complete comprehensive list. And so we'll be making that available to the committee and the public also.
I'm looking forward to seeing where a state senator lies on that list.
Very high, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure, yes. Yeah.
Senator Hughes.
Thank you. My understanding, based on Dr. Knapp's presentation in the spring, and then what I heard yesterday, based on, do you remember the slide that had the gray and black bars, and the one that was more harmful as far as reducing jobs was permanent fund, then came income tax, then came sales tax with exclusions was the least. And so let's say least harmful is over here. Most harmful is over here. So we're talking sales tax, income tax, permanent fund capping and as being harmful and reducing jobs. And also what I remember from Dr. Knapp, along that same pattern was that that being less harmful to the economy, that let me just leave it at that, because we've heard conversations and Dr. Hartley or Mr. Hartley mentioned at one point that he thought sales tax, you know, was really bad because of his brother-in-law, but then later said something about you'd be open to the permanent fund, but that's also very regressive. Oh, I guess, yes, okay, here, I got my thought back, because that harmful, less harmful to more harmful, also had to do with being less regressive to more regressive, is what I understood from Dr. Knapp. So I find it interesting that people kind of tend towards, what I'm hearing today is leaning towards the permanent fund and income tax as opposed to sales tax, so I'll just say that. The other thing, and I mentioned this yesterday, and I just want to get on the record again, and we heard this from Dr. Knapp, that non-residents would pay a larger portion of a sales tax than they would of an income tax. And that is, again, because of the $2 million tourists. So I just want to get that on the record. But now my question is, I have seen a body of work that is kind of almost opposite to some of what we've been hearing, in that reducing government is better for the economy, reducing budgets are better for the economy than taxing. And that's kind of the opposite of what I'm hearing today. And you think back to the Reagan era, he was all about lowering taxes and it stimulated the economy. And part of that, and I mentioned it yesterday, it's really important that new money is coming in, that capital investment that you brought up, Mr. Beadle. And as we know, governments don't produce money. I mean, we do have a lot to do with the economy, 15% of it here in the state, and we do bring in federal dollars, so there is some outside money coming in. So my question is, do you recognize that there is a thinking that's almost opposite to what we're talking about, and that how do you explain what happened when Ronald Reagan reduced taxes and it stimulated the economy? And if you're looking at those outside dollars, if you reduce your footprint of government and your budget, but you're careful about still leveraging those outside federal dollars, and you're keeping taxes low and not going there so that the private sector has the capital to make investment, isn't that better? I mean, what I'm hearing seems to almost to be opposite of what seems like logical sense to me. And so if I know that was kind of a sprawling question, but basically, how do you explain what happened during the Reagan era, and are you aware that there are some economists that are basically saying the opposite of what you're saying?
May I just see a show of hands of anyone who'd like to take the first stab at the answer to this? Okay. Dr. Townsend and then Mr. Beadle. Thank you.
So Ralph Townsend from ICER speaking. First of all, the issue of residents versus non-residents paying sales taxes and income taxes depends on a lot of details. In particular, you have to recognize that one of the issues about who's paying it is income tax, federal income tax deductibility. And while both are deductible, the reality is higher income individuals itemize more often, and consequently an income tax typically generates, again, it depends on how the tax is structured, but an income tax will typically generate more federal, more reductions in federal income tax than a sales tax. So you have to be careful about modeling that, and while the general answer that I think is probably correct is there are probably small differences between the amount collected from out-of-state residents on sales taxes versus income taxes. But unless you do something that targets the sales tax very narrowly, rooms and meals taxes and that sort of thing, which is problematic in itself because...
Dr. Townsend, do you mind repeating what you just said? I didn't grab that.
Again, how you design a sales tax, what's covered by the sales tax, what isn't covered, will determine to a very great extent who's paying it. And one of the, again, there are some trade-offs here about how much for every additional dollar you get from out of state, to what extent are you willing to incur other disadvantages in state. So if you end up with a relatively high sales tax for a certain part of the year, for example, the proposal to have seasonal ones, there's some administrative costs to go with that. Are you willing to do it? Are you willing to risk the fact that, well, you've got a 9% tax on a narrow band, and so it has some disadvantages for some of your businesses? I think, in general, what the numbers show on taxes are that how you take $100 million out in taxes doesn't make a big impact, in the short run at least, in terms of total employment. The distributional effects are more important. Yes, there are small differences. Slightly different assumptions will get you a slightly different answer. But really, then, those probably aren't big enough to drive the answer. And that's why the distributional issue of a sales tax and a change in the PFD typically is more regressive than an income tax, is why people like Marcus Hartley say, given the weights, I would say I think that the progressive effect of the income tax is important enough, so I put my finger on the income tax as opposed to other. But in terms of the overall economic impact, I'd say Marcus and I would probably say it's probably a wash on the economy except for the distributional impact on taxes. On the PFD, it's a little different, and again, it was interesting because Jonathan King yesterday came to a slightly different conclusion than ICER. ICER assumes that a very large percentage of the PFD is spent. And that assumes that, and Jonathan King said they've done a survey, which I haven't had a chance to look at in 24 hours, that says actually only about 60% of it is spent in a given year. And that is lower than I would have expected, but if that's the answer, then the distributional consequences are quite different. It's, again, the difference between a PFD change and a tax change, I still think, is largely distributional. Whether the exact impact on the economy is less important than the distributional effects. It, getting to the second question of the Reagan era and the tax cuts that went in that period, you have to remember that, yes, there were tax cuts, but those were financed primarily by larger federal deficits. And Alaska cannot run permanent deficits the way the federal government can. So yes, if you could not institute a tax and finance yourself by deficits indefinitely, that would be preferable to raising taxes. But that's not an option for states. It was an option for the federal government at that point. There is the issue. How big do we want to create a big government simply for the purpose of propelling the economy forward in the short run? And on that I fall back on my first answer, which was early on when I said, we want to pay for the government we want. We want to ask ourselves, how many child protection workers do we want in Alaska? That's the important long-run question. Yes, those people don't bring in money from outside, but they provide a service to Alaska that's important. And the government we want in the long run is not a government because it's bigger, because it stimulates the economy, or it's smaller because we have some view that it won't stimulate the economy. We want to buy those park services, those child protection services, those criminal justice services, those educational services that we want in the long run. Those services add to our society. They address social issues that have social and economic consequences. That's what we want to be moving towards in the long run. And we want to keep that long run view in mind as we make the short run decisions.
Mr. Beadle was going to answer, but first I'm going to let Senator Stevens ask Senator Hughes' follow-up question.
I'm sorry, just follow up, Dr. Townsend. The comment was made yesterday, I don't remember who, but the comment was that as we cut back on, say, fisheries, investment in fisheries, funding our fish and game, the end result has been a reduction in the catch, a reduction to the individual fisherman, because we don't know what the resource is and we're not able to fully utilize it. Would you agree with that?
I'm not familiar with the specific details.
I know you are a fisheries person.
I have to confess, I too am a fisheries economist. And part of my interest in Alaska just personally was I've been here working on fisheries economics. But I don't know the exact example that was cited. But I think it does get to the point that government workers provide services for us. We value the road infrastructure. Coming from states that plow the roads, I was a resident of Maine. When I lived in Maine, I did not buy studded tires. Not because they didn't get snow, but because they were very aggressive in plowing. Those services, so you get my preferences. I would prefer a little more snow plowing, even if I have to pay for it in Alaska. You might prefer more the appropriate. So here's the question of what's the appropriate amount of services. And I appreciate this is not an easy question. What's the appropriate amount of, and I'll come back to the child protection services. Those are important services. It's unfortunate that we have to provide them, but we do, and we care about them. And we have to ask ourselves, are the caseloads that we have for those services appropriate for the demands we have? That's the important long-run question. And we don't want to justify government workers as saying, oh, they're a boost to the economy or they're a drain on the economy. They provide services that we want. And I appreciate, again, from being from outside, Alaska's in a difficult position. In the past, it's not had to say, how much government are we willing to pay for? Somebody else is paying more, we'll take more government. Now Alaska has to ask, almost on a program-by-program basis, what is it that we need in this area to serve the people of Alaska? And many of those services are hidden services that many of your constituents don't see. They may not see the criminal justice. Many of your employees may not have a lot of interaction with the correction system, but it's an important service for us. With a little luck, many of them stay out of the court system. But the court system is important to the functioning of our society. And it's important, again, court services, it's important not to have a backlog so that we have justice delayed. Those are the kinds of long-term questions. Not philosophically should government be bigger or smaller, but what are the services we want?
Thank you. Mr. Beadle, were you interested in answering that question, or did you want to also dovetail? Okay, thank you. Senator Hughes, would you like to restate your question just for those who've been listening online and perhaps have, we just need to recenter, I guess, where we were.
I'm going to really make it simple, and I don't know if Dr. Townsend wants to address it or if anyone wants to address it. I guess I would say despite the fact that the tax cuts during the Reagan era were funded by the federal deficit, just take that off the table, how do you explain the economic growth that occurred during that time of tax cuts?
Thank you, Mr. Beadle.
Madam Chair, the question that Senator Hughes asked, we have a great example in Alaska. We do not tax individuals on a state basis for income tax or for sales tax, so it's hard to create a stimulus, which was the case with President Reagan, to lower something. So we can't lower something from zero. In the case where we have taxed oil and then reduced or changed the tax regime, we actually incented oil, and we got a return on that investment. That investment slowed the decline and has today produced some new finds. So it has worked in Alaska for that industry, and because of the disconnect of Alaskans not paying for taxes, it's hard to stimulate. If you had it's like lowering interest rates, which monetary policy has done in this country for more than 10 years, and it has to some degree. It's worn out because you can't go lower, much lower than today's interest rates, and we could get off on that monetary policy. Fiscal policy involves taxes and involves how the state spends money. And so today, if we added taxes, we didn't have one, that actually is going to take away from our economy. And if we spent more, it could actually take away from our economy because we have to tax to do that, even though it might stay in the state. There's one more aspect that is important in terms of tax base. So if you consider the number of customers, so put yourself as a bond underwriting entity. And so if you are going to buy bonds and the rating agencies are going to look at you, the broader the base of taxes, all of the taxes, we talked earlier, Mark Romick did, on assessed valuations in a municipality and what we call unrestricted revenue, the sovereign's ability to tax. So the greater the tax base, the assessed value, and the mill rate, the lower, the less impact. But if you had, we're not going to a property tax as a state. We're looking at income tax and sales tax. If you were a bond, if you were going to buy a portion of the bond for Alaska and you saw that we were a diversified revenue beyond just oil, and you had mining and fisheries and fuel and sales and income tax, as a lender, which I am, you say you have diversity of income sources. You have a broader reach for a tax base, and that is a good thing. And so answering from a banker's perspective, that broad base is going to help and say one's up, one's down, one industry's different. You have a diversified portfolio of taxation. So one was incentive, which we've used in the past for oil. We don't have taxes to lower. So when we, so I think you get it. Yeah.
So do members have any other questions of the panelists? Okay. I think I'd like to take the final 25 minutes of the committee, and again, I want to thank you for making time out of your schedules to be here. I think we're planning on taking all of your plane tickets and keeping them aside so you can stay for the rest of the session and help us out. But I say that in jest, but I really do appreciate your contributions. This has been an important series of hearings that the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee has had, and it's invaluable, and I appreciate it. So with that, excuse me?
I just say the audience sort of tells you the broader interest.
Yes, thank you, Senator Gardner. So with that, I wanted to give each of you a chance just to any final thoughts, anything that you've heard that you want to respond to, that you know, it's up to you. And so I'd like each of you to just have a chance to provide that to the committee. So it's sort of like the open-ended question on the essay test. So, and I'll start with our Department of Labor and Workforce Development lead researcher, Dan Robinson. Mr. Robinson?
Sure. Madam Chair, the
I think it's important and helpful for you to think conceptual broad strokes. So, and I hope that some of what you've heard today is helpful there. What is the money currently doing? So whether it's, if it's non-resident income, if somebody flies into the North Slope from Spokane and flies home, the loss of that job has very small multiplier. On the other hand, if they travel from Palmer to the North Slope, make the same salary, but pay a mortgage, groceries, local property taxes, a much larger multiplier. So the details matter, but the conceptual, and one other quick thing, and then I'll zip it. But models are, by definition, simplifications. So that's useful, but it's useful conceptually broad strokes. There are things that economists will never agree on, and fiscal policy, monetary policy, the extent to which a tax cut created an economic boom, that's one of them. Economists on both sides of the political aisle will forever disagree. But there's a fair amount that they do agree on, and that's that money circulates. The higher the wage, the more it circulates, some of those things. So I encourage you to kind of think conceptually. If I take this money from there, what's it doing now? Is it being re-spent, or is it growing somewhere for our future use? Those kinds of things, I think, will be hopefully a little bit helpful as you navigate the tough political waters.
Thank
That's
you.
It for me.
I appreciate that. Mr. Romick from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, your final thoughts or any comments to what you've heard?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that I couldn't provide any more eloquent response to any of the questions about the, what scenario that you'd be looking at than these gentlemen have. But I will say that, you know, from a housing perspective, the whatever happens, the scenario that has the least amount of impact on people's investment decisions in the housing market will create the greatest stability in the housing market. And keeping in mind what those impacts are as you move forward, I think will be helpful to you and to the people in the housing industry in Alaska.
Thank you very much. Mr. Hartley with Northern Economics.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you for having us. I think I've learned a lot just sitting here listening. I guess I wanted to just say a few words. I really think it's important that we do make some decisions and try to eliminate a lot of the uncertainty about how we will fix our fiscal house. Is very important. However it's done, I thought Dr. Townsend's statement about taxes and the distributional effects may be more important than the actual overall economic effects. Who has to pay the money does matter almost as much as what the money does in the economy. And I like the terms progressive and regressive in terms of taxes. And I'm going to always favor a more progressive tax where the folks that can afford to pay the taxes, as opposed to everybody paying the same rate. I don't like flat rate taxes because I believe that significantly disadvantages the less advantaged folks in our economy. I guess that's really where I would put my biggest emphasis.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hartley. And next we have Mr. Joe Beadle with Northrim Bank. Your final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we started with these overviews from the economists, the Department of Labor, employment numbers, and showing, you know, potentially 2% drops for 3 years in a row. And so that is very disheartening. But I want to speak to the opportunities. It might be a new normal at a different plateau, but it is not debilitating for the state. We were not overbuilt, and so this concept of, you know, Alaska, resetting and back to a stable new plateau is okay. And we can do well, and we can provide the basic services that are needed for the state, but it is time to pay, so to speak. And this concept of the permanent fund, you know, what is available today, and the fact that we've accumulated those earnings reserves, are so much different. It's a bird in hand. It is cash in hand. It is available. It doesn't have to be drawn from someone in those overhead costs of collections and monitoring and policing and coming up with. So this concept, it is available to leverage and use, is so important because it can be fairly immediate. The other ones are going to take time. So we agree that all of these are hard. Lowering expenditures by the state will hurt the economy. Raising all these taxes will hurt the economy. And frankly, the difference between those levers are marginal. You know, when you looked at the grid, per 100 million of revenue, the job losses from all of those levers did not vary by more than 25%. So you didn't have an easy decision, and that's why we argue try to use all of the decisions. So the state can moderate and be healthy, but going back to a normal citizen partially supported government is critical at this time, and the delay of making those decisions and the uncertainty of those decisions is going to hurt our economy. So the sooner we can make those decisions and respond to those decisions is what we're asking for, discipline and a hope that we have that early instead of later, because it's past time.
Thank you. I personally hear you loud and clear, and I appreciate your remarks. And finally, we'll wrap up with Dr. Townsend with Institute of Social and Economic Research.
Thank you, Senator Costello. Thank you very much for inviting me here today. We're very pleased. ICE was always pleased to participate in the important public discussions about the state's economy and the state budget. I guess I'll leave with three things. The first one is that Alaska needs to realize that while it faces challenges fiscally, it also has huge opportunities because of the permanent fund. I was in the lower 48 in 2010, and a 3% state budget deficit was an enormous crisis, because these other states don't have a permanent fund. They had rainy day funds that were 1 or 2% of the state budget, not 300 or 400% of the state budget. So Alaska's permanent fund provides opportunities to manage the transition that other states would have killed for. In 2007, killed for. I mean, they would just say, "You're kidding! You had 4 years in the bank." So you need to realize that that's why this is an opportunity. But the second thing related to that, part of that same issue, is that permanent fund is very much part of Alaska's future. It is probably a bigger part of Alaska's future than all of its natural resources combined. And Alaska needs to think about its future in terms of financial management of that fund and how it's used. But that is really the transition that I think Alaskans are largely struggling with. The fund has in the past given us the dividend. Now we need to say, how is it going to shape our future? So that's a very big, it's a big change, but it's an opportunity that's really unique to Alaska. The second thing I would say is that when you hear that we're worried about a crisis, it's not that someone wants a two-year plan to solve this. I'll be honest, I think that realistically, starting with the five-year plan and recognizing that by the time you get done tweaking that, you really use 10 years for this adjustment. Not that you can put action off for 10 years. But in the first 5 years, you may decide to do things like go back to my child protection work. You may decide to cut that too much. Then you'll come back and say, you know, actually, that was a mistake. Because understanding what services are worth once you have to pay for them Other states have been paying for them for quite a long time. They've been having that discussion. But when we talk about a plan, it's not about a plan to solve this in a year or two. It's about laying out a blueprint for everyone to see where we're going. A plan is not cast in stone, but it gives everybody reasonable expectations about where we're going. And I guess the third point I'd make is that I appreciate that the details seem overwhelming at times, but the details do matter. And that when you look at, and I'll pick an example from Senator Hughes yesterday, the question about Medicaid funding and the formula funding. That someone reminded me after, you know, this is really a complicated question, because would it be good for Alaska in the long run to manage its health care costs better? And we can probably all say in the long run that sounds like a good thing. In the short run, if we take money away from the health care sector, it's going to have a negative. And remember, in the case of Medicaid, where perhaps it's a $2 federal match for every dollar, if we take $3 out of the health care sector, two of those were coming from the federal government. So for every $1 we cut our expenditures, we may be reducing the amount that's coming in from out of state. I'm not suggesting that should drive our decision, but I'm saying that when we look at those, we have to consider those details. Many of these things are intertwined with other decisions. And simply saying, well, isn't this one better or that one better? The details do matter, and certainly the various committees need to take the time to understand those details and the interconnections, because what you don't want to do is a year later to find out, oh, I didn't understand that negative consequence. So those are my three comments. The permanent fund is really an opportunity that requires a shift in thinking on the part of Alaska. You're really thinking about a five-year plan that will be corrected over 10 years. And the third one is the details do matter as you deal with many of the aspects of program and taxes and changes to the permanent fund. Thank you very much for inviting
me. Thank you, Dr. Townsend, for your thoughtful comments. So with that, we'll be wrapping up the committee. And I did want to mention that next week, on Tuesday, we will be looking at key economic indicators in Alaska's economy. We'll be hearing from the tourism industry on tourism trends. We will have before us the air cargo industry and the healthcare and insurance industries. And then on Thursday, we will be looking at the question, does Alaska need to develop an economic development strategy? So on Thursday, we'll hear from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and also the regional development groups on the regional economic development plans that they put together. So with that, I want to thank the members who are here and also those other legislators who joined us and those who listened in online, and, of course, finally, our panelists who made time out of your schedules to be here. Thank you very much. Senator Hughes?
I just wanted to make one closing comment. So since we're on the end of a wonderful two-day, I want to thank you for arranging this and for your committee aide, Weston. It's been very enlightening. And one of my takeaways yesterday was that 2018 is the year that we can absorb the shock of something more substantial. And I just want to point out, you know, we're all returning legislators, and we all took a lot of heat from the press, et cetera, and others, that we didn't do something more substantial last session. And as it turns out, 2017 would not have been the best year for that to be implemented. So I just want to make that point, because that was one of those takeaways of yesterday that was pretty key to me. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Senator Hughes, and you join us from the House, and you're the vice chair of the committee. So with that, we will adjourn and see you on Tuesday.